Welcome to Complexified, where religion and politics collide with real life. I'm your host, Amanda Henderson. Today, we talk with one of my dear friends, Pastor and Professor Reverend Dr. Jennifer Leith. She is Black and queer and determined to be a mother. That sounds like a simple thing, but in fact, the obstacles that have been in her way are so great that she decided that the next best way to make her dream happen was to leave the United States. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you so much. It's so good to join you.
So I know that you are a clergy person in the AME Church, African Methodist Episcopal Church. I know that you're a pastor and a professor. Tell me about your beginnings. How did that come to be?
Well, I guess I would have to begin with just acknowledging that by whatever coincidence, I was born into a family that was part of the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And this became the first and primary site for my encounter with God, for my encounters with God. And it is also true that I'm at least the fifth generation of ordained pastors or preachers in the AME Church.
Oh my goodness.
On my dad's side. And my mom's father was also ordained in the AME Church.
Yeah.
And so
can you say real quick for our listeners who might not be familiar with the history of the AME Church and why that is such a kind of pillar in American religion, honestly?
The AME Church was founded in the late 1700s, incorporated in 1816, but there were a group of people of African descent, formerly enslaved people, who were worshiping in St. George's Methodist Episcopal Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and they were worshiping in this church and were seated in the balcony. And so they were segregated. And at a point, as the story goes, they were praying too loudly. And one of the kind of ways that we tell this story is that Richard Allen and Absalom Jones, who were leaders among this group, were tapped on the shoulder and asked to please quiet down or else to leave. And they indicated that they would finish praying. And once they did so, they would go. And they went, and they didn't come back. And from that point, they partnered with the Free African Society, which was largely populated by Quakers. And so there was a common interest in abolition and a common commitment to the work of abolition. And then ultimately, in a blacksmith shop on 6th and Lombard, Richard Allen established what would become the AME Church, which was Bethel, and later became Mother Bethel. The denomination, though, has these kind of abolitionist roots, but not just abolitionist in the sense of a kind of commitment to ending formal slavery or slavery as such, but a deeper commitment to freedom.
Yeah.
to freedom and self-determination. And so those elements are very important to me in terms of what it means to be a member and a clergy person in the AME Church.
Yeah. So if you're five generations, what year would that have been? How early?
Oh, man. I'd have to do some math on that, but it would be not long after the Civil War.
Yeah.
If after the Civil War, it may have even predated.
Yeah. And how long has the denomination ordained women?
Not nearly that long.
Uh-huh.
And I should have a year for you. And
that's all right.
And I could get that for you. But what's quite interesting, though, is that there's a story about Jerina Lee,
uh-huh.
who was one of the earliest women preachers in the denomination, and she felt the call to preach, and in fact felt that call on one occasion when another person was preaching and was unable to continue doing so. And so she took up and finished the sermon.
Look at her.
Richard Allen was not as excited about her call to preach. And at first resisted her being a preacher in the fledgling denomination. However, she ended up receiving his blessing to preach and to do so in a circuit, a preaching circuit in that in the New Jersey area. And while she was doing this, interestingly enough, Richard Allen and his wife helped care for her children.
Wow.
It's really kind of an extraordinary story. And so while it does not satisfy the legitimizing fact, if you will, or possibility of ordination, it certainly does clarify that early as the founder, it was clear that women in the tradition were inspired mm-hmm. to preach.
Mm-hmm. How did your parents and grandparents receive you when you decided that this was your calling?
Well, it's funny. There's a kind of funny story about this. My grandmother, my dad's mom, she was one of the people who I talked to about this. Even, I don't know, it must have been 10 years before I accepted the call, maybe 9 or 10 years before I accepted the call to preach when I was about 16. And I told her that I'd like to either be a rapper or a preacher. and she...
Maybe both.
She was like, please be a rapper.
That's perfect.
And I think it's interesting because I think the reasons behind that were, on one hand, she had experienced how cruel and how harsh church could be.
Yeah.
How cruel and harsh the AME church could be and what it could do to families and especially to the families of clergy people.
Yeah.
And how it can circumscribe certain life possibilities and opportunities. And then I think, too, in a very strange and kind of different vein, she was also concerned with the mannishness of women preachers who she heard. And so there were women preachers she was encountering who just kind of had this sort of way of preaching that to her reflected something that was not feminine in the ways that she thought would be ideal.
Interesting. Yeah. When did you start to realize that your own sexuality might also be at odds with the traditions and the teachings of the church that you were in?
So I was probably around 10.
Oh,
very early.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, I can't really quite explain it. But I mean, as is common to some people in childhood, there were different kinds of exploration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
explorations that kids just kind of do as they're figuring out who they are. And as those went for me, it was clear that that where it felt right to me was with someone of the same gender.
Mm-hmm.
And where that kind of development made sense to me was again with someone of the same gender. And I think I probably would not have figured out words to talk about that or think about that, except that a well-intentioned church member offered, rather gave me, gifted me for Christmas one year, a journal when I was 13. And this journal became an opportunity for me to really write what was going on. And so I wrote about what some of those experiences and explorations looked like. And there were reflections of experiences with boys, experiences with girls. And on one unfortunate day that has had a kind of more lovely outcome, as it were, my mom read my journal. And decided that given what it said, I can also say as an aside that had I read what she read, I would have done the same thing.
Yeah.
But she decided that it was necessary to talk about what was in there. And the way that conversation went was interesting because at a point she asked in a kind of rhetorical tone, you know that this is not right to be involved with or to be kind of sexually active with someone of the same gender. You know that that's not right. And you know what our faith says about that. And I said, yes, I understand. I know that. And I explained that I had not experienced it as something that was wrong, but that I did understand that it was wrong. it was wrong. And I have to say that even in that moment, I felt in many ways compelled to say that, right? I felt like there wasn't really an option. It was a rhetorical question. It wasn't really an invitation. It was like, if you're going to get out of this room, if you're going to get out of this conversation, if you're going to make it to the next day after this trauma.
There isn't much more traumatic than your mother reading your journal when you're 13 years old. So
no. And then telling you, you know, what she thinks about it.
Yeah. Oh.
So, yeah, it's one of those moments where it's, you know, you're whatever you say, Mom, is right.
Just get me out of here,
say,
quick.
Whatever you say. But I was so grateful that between three to 4 years later, a few things happened. And one of them was that I accepted the call to preach.
Mm-hmm.
I experienced what I might describe as a baptism in the Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
And that encounter was very, and the way that manifested was very clearly notwithstanding, although still relevant to and related to my sexuality. And then I also went to the Youth Theology Institute at Emory's Candler School. And I met people there who were queer and Christian.
Wow.
And when I got back from that month there, my parents were asking me, well, you know, how was it? And, you know, what did you learn? What happened? And one of the things that I was able to say is that God loves gay people. And that...
Say that again.
God loves gay people. Mm. And God loves LGBTQ people. Mm-hmm. And that God... And that there are people who are LGBTQ who also love God.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And who have... given their lives to a faithful witness mm-hmm. to who God is.
Yeah. Okay, now, how did your grandma take it? Did she want you to be a rapper?
Well, so I love that you asked that question, because I wanted to fast forward to maybe mid to late college years. When I had, by that point, formally come out to both my parents, but I had a chance to just sit with my grandmother one day, and in this time that we spent together, I shared with her. I said, you know, I'm gay, and she said, okay, and wasn't too bothered by it, and then and then I said, you know, the only thing that is a little bit difficult about this is that I really want to conceive. I really want to be able to have a child. And I, well, I'll go ahead with the story.
Yeah.
Because what she said was, oh, you know, you could just go ahead and sleep with someone and do that. You could just do that and then move on.
That's very pragmatic, Grandma.
It was really pragmatic. It was really pragmatic. And at the same time, it flew in the face of everything that I had been taught implicitly and explicitly in terms of sexual ethics and morality around, you know, what sex is, what sex means, and how sex is meant to be between a cisgender heterosexual man and a cisgender heterosexual woman in the context of marriage. And that is where that belongs.
So there's this disconnect between, like, the theories and the beliefs and the doctrine and, first, your lived experience personally, and then how those who loved you actually continued to love you always. And it sounds like there that you've been in that tension many times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That tension is, In some ways, I think part of a kind of shaping and a formation, really a spiritual formation, to do the work that I feel called to do and to be who I feel called to be. I do feel called to bear witness to the love and the goodness of God. And I feel called to bear witness to that in my full self, in the fullness of who I am as a queer woman.
Mm-hmm. How has that longing for motherhood continued to grow since that time? What has that journey been for you?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's looked like three different types of attempts to conceive at home, and two intrauterine inseminations, IUIs, and a journey with respect to the question of whether or not I can afford next steps in terms of in vitro fertilization. And then it has looked like a choice to move to a place where in at least one round of in vitro fertilization is covered for whosoever will, those who are eligible for and covered in the health services that are provided here in Canada.
Can you go back to that realization that where you were physically and in your work, and you had a great job, you had a house and community. When did you realize that you couldn't live into the fullness of yourself and what you hope for in that space, and you had to go somewhere else?
Yeah, I think that that moment is just the kind of collision of, whoa, this next step is going to take, it would require $30,000. And whoa, there's a possibility of a place where a different balance is honored, and a different life balance is honored, and it includes and is expressed also through covering this expense.
Yeah, healthcare and
healthcare.
Yeah, what a powerful representation of taking action. And I think that so many people right now feel helpless in the face of systems of oppression, of, you know, after the overturning of Roe versus Wade and the Dobbs decision, a lot of people saying, how can we change this? How can we take action? That's another example of living in a world where the systems are counter to our well-being. What do you tell people, what do you tell students about taking action in the midst of oppressive systems?
Well, the most important thing I teach, I think, and hope, is critical thinking. A hermeneutics of suspicion, right?
Interpreting what is that?
World.
I love that phrase, yeah.
Right. Interpreting the world and the texts, the various sacred texts that are our lives and that that enliven our lives or our experiences. Taking all of the texts and the subtexts and reading them, observing them, analyzing them in ways that don't accept the easy answer, that don't accept the answer that everyone else gives, that don't accept the answer or the explanation or the interpretation that is most popular or that others have offered before. To think not only critically, but also, and I think more importantly, imaginatively and creatively, to really contemplate other possibilities.
Yeah.
Contemplate alternatives. And I think also learning how to tell our stories, right?
Can you give one example of what that looks like? The enacting that hermeneutic of suspicion, reading your text with that against the grain strategy, what does it look like to take action through critical thinking?
Yeah, I think it does involve a kind of courageous, holy boldness of telling the difficult parts of our stories,
like telling, you're doing today.
I fail sometimes miserably, but I try my best to practice what I preach. And I think along with that, the way that that happens is by allowing our lives to be the sermon, right? This is the testimony. This is the word. and so there are different ways that we can tell our stories. And I think taking the first steps to tell them and then thinking about how to retell them and to tell them again and again in new ways that are true, that are true and that align with not only the work that our souls must have, as Katie Cannon might put it, but also align with the best that we can imagine mm-hmm. of what we, the world, and we in the world could be. Mm-hmm.
Is there a time with for yourself that you felt like that was it? I was just living that which I can't not live.
So I have moments like that in writing sometimes and in teaching sometimes and also in preaching. There are moments, especially I would say in preaching, when I know that I am not only speaking my truth or the truth as it's been shown to me or revealed to me, but that I am doing so in a way that might just be serving the abolition causes of the individuals and communities that hear. I think that happens for me also. I mean, and it's really interesting because sometimes before I am coming out, and it's true. I mean, coming out is just a process, and one does it over and over and over again. And in so many ways, what I'm sharing with you is yet another coming out. It's a coming out again, another coming out story, another part of my coming out and coming out story. But every now and then, I will be writing something, or I'll be preparing something that I'll preach about, and the Spirit just won't let it out. And then it just nudges me, and I feel, oh, wait, this is a time, this is a place, this is a space where I have to show myself. That I have to share myself, that I have to come out, as it were. Because, I don't know, I mean, that charismatic Pentecostal and Methodical aspect of who I am, and also perhaps the Quaker mm-hmm. in me every now and then, would have to say that, you know, where it just kind of do that cherry picking work here that we do as preachers sometimes, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. And I mean, that's real. That's true. And I think for me, and to me also, where the Spirit of God is, liberty is cultivated, is nurtured, is embraced, is made possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What good word do you bring as someone from a tradition of abolition to a time when people question the freedom of their own body?
I think that in this time, it's essential that we recalibrate the ways we think about the cycle of life that includes death. And my word to the present day abolitionists, the abolitionists who are fighting against the prison industrial complex, the abolitionists who are fighting against capitalist systems and structures and models and ways of being, the abolitionists who are fighting for freedom and self-determination of body and of one's own body, that this is a fight that that is a matter of life and death, not in the sense so much that if we don't fight it, we'll die. Well, yes, mm-hmm. that's true. If we don't fight it, we'll die. But it's a matter of life and death insofar as we have not rightly seen the relationship between life and death, that we don't understand the relationship of these two one another.
What do you mean by that? Where is that, that we don't understand that relationship between life and death?
I think it's in this, that in every moment, in every instance, death is happening and life is happening. And so much of the conversation around reproductive rights has really centered on this question of when does life begin? Well, life begins before the womb.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So if I were to not pursue conception, would that be going against the will of God? If I believe that it might be God's will for me to conceive?
Yeah.
Especially if it's in a kind of the mind of the divine, if it's in the will of the divine, even prior to the womb. Where does life begin? Life began generations ago.
Yeah.
Life began with my ancestors. Where does life begin? Life began before even time began. And so in every instance of life, death has also been a part. You know, I have none of the same cells now that I had 7 years ago in my physical being. They have all been shed. So I'm not who I was. And none of us are. And we all go through a process of life and death at every point. And so a recalibration of how we think about life and how we think about life in relation to death, I think can help us to figure out how to be free and how to get free in many different ways, in terms of who we are as reproducing bodies, but also as who we are as carceral subjects, who we are in terms of the constraints that I think the heteropatriarchal capitalist system puts on each and every one of us day in and day out. It has to do with being willing to say sometimes death has to happen. In fact, sometimes I'd be willing to put my life on the line for a thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
when it is the, I would say the holy or the sacred or the divine abolitionist call. I'm willing to put my life on the line. And we must die and be willing to die for that. No one else should make that decision for me.
Yeah, yeah.
That yes. life or death decision is mine to make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is where it really, like, we need more nuance and conversation. And what is an action that people can take to learn more, to engage in that more nuanced conversation about these questions of life and death and conception and moving beyond simple textual sound bites to our lived experience in connection with our relationships.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think as we do that work, as we think about that, I think we will emerge with new ways of nurturing life and understanding death.
Mm-hmm. Now you moved to find the freedom to become a mother, freedom for you in the ways that you're able to have greater access to that opportunity. The child that you imagine, what do you hope for them? What is one thing you hope that they know in their bones as they grow up? A free child.
That the choice is theirs. That choice is theirs. I want that child to know they have choices. They will always have choices. We can choose to pursue freedom or not. Mm-hmm. We can choose to pursue sustainable futures or not. We can choose to believe in the divine or not. We can choose to believe in the divine in some ways and frameworks and according to some traditions or not. Mm-hmm. We can choose, and it's not always the dualistic choice between one thing or another, that there are also always a multiplicity of choices.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I so admire you, you know that. And I admire your courage and your ability to listen and the deep clarity that it sounds like you've had since you were a child, and that you have continued to listen to and model and teach to those who surround you. So thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for joining us. I am sure you have a lot of questions after today's episode. So for more resources and ideas you can use to explore and to share with your community, visit our website in the show notes. And if anything in this conversation inspired you, please share it with a friend. That is the very best way to support us. Complexified is presented by the Institute for Religion, Politics, and Culture at ILEF School of Theology. Lex Dunbar is an invaluable member of the team. Also working behind the scenes are engineer Andrew Perella, producer Elaine Appleton Grant, Tina Basir, and the rest of the crew at Podcast Allies. I'm Amanda Henderson.